throughout my training, I've honestly, even as a Christian, been surprised with how many Christians I come in contact with through my work.
I studied how a single cell becomes an organism, and it's such a complex process. I mean, there are so many different points that it could go completely haywire. The fact that it ever went well and you ever got a whole organism was a miracle. And then the fact that it happens all the time, over and over in such an amazing way, really just strengthened my faith.
To see the things that we're able to see under a microscope and explore the things we're able to explore and really try to tease apart the intricacies of the way that our bodies work, really, it just encourages my faith.
Science is God's, you know? He established it, and he gives us the know-how, how to learn about his creation, but there's nothing that disproves him in any way.
Science cannot explain everything. Science was started by people who understood that there has to be a foundation to science, and that foundation, the best foundation, is that of biblical Christianity.
Science is a methodology that helps us explore God's universe, but it's very limited. It doesn't help us explain things like love, our emotions, things that are really hard. You can't just grab love and hold on to it like you can a plant or clothing.
I can use the empirical world to help me understand the nature of God and the structure of God's creation. But as a transcendent being, God is more than the world. And it just simply, there's no reason why my understanding of a transcendent being is limited to my understanding of the physical world in and of itself.
It really would take more faith to believe that there is no God and that everything that we experience or the world that we see is based simply on the random interaction of molecules.
And I know people fervently believe there's no God, but I'm kind of going, dude, it's like a big universe. And if I were to draw the universe, it'd be like one tiny, tiny little dot. And you're going to make a pronouncement sitting here in Columbia or Boston or San Francisco or London. I'm sure there's no God in anywhere of all of creation. Now, you could say that, but it's really a faith statement, isn't it? I choose by faith to believe there's no God.
This God who created everything creates some of the most magnificent structures and anatomy and physiology that the human mind can barely comprehend. The more we find out about how the human body is put together, the more amazing it is that God did all of this.
Last week, Keith preached on the seventh day that we read about in Genesis chapter 2, 1 through 3, and he talked about how God's seventh day, his resting on the seventh day and our observing the seventh day in a Sabbath kind of worship reflects God's rule over creation and points to God's rule over our lives. And Keith was happy. He mentioned in the service last Sunday that he was happy more than anybody else to be leaving Genesis chapter 1 and going to Genesis chapter 2. And I'm here to say not so fast. We have finished now the 7 days. Chapter 2, verses 1 through 3 was the seventh day. And so what I'd like to do before we move forward is I'd like to talk about the 7 days of Genesis. I have to confess that my big motivation in doing this is because I come across people all the time who are confused because they hear sort of the narrative of the conflict between science and Christianity. They're confused by the claim of many natural scientists that say that because we have disproven the claims of Genesis chapter 1, the 6 days, the earth, the universe being created in 6 days, therefore we have disproven, science has disproven the Bible, and therefore disproven Christianity itself, which of course may come as surprising news to many of the scientists that are good friends of mine that are devout followers of Jesus, many of whom you saw in the video we filmed them a couple years ago, who are still members of this church, still devout followers of Jesus. But I think that one reason why some scientists claim that science has disproven Genesis 1 is that good scientists don't often make good Bible scholars. And the reason why is because not they're dumb, they're very smart, but the training is so different. To be a good scientist is very, very different in training than to be a good Bible scholar, studying languages and studying literature that is thousands of years old, very, very different from any kind of literature that we have now. When we come to the kind and the type of ancient literature that we find in Genesis 1, we have to remember, even though our English translations are very good and they smooth it out and it sounds so modern, we're actually reading very ancient literature that is thousands of years old. Particularly Genesis, we're reading something probably 3,000, maybe 3,400 years old. So if we try to read it like some sort of modern chronological narrative, we are guaranteed to misread it, at least much of it. Remember I said months ago, maybe a few months ago when I was starting this, we were starting this series, and I said that Genesis 1 and 2 is more like a Van Gogh painting of Saint-Rémy, France, you know, with the big broad strokes that show movement and the exaggerated stars of the moon and the moon of the night sky as Vincent van Gogh would look out his window in the morning. And he wanted to show the transcendent beauty and the glory, and he did it in a very broad way versus looking at a photograph of Saint-Rémy, France. It's very, very precise, but it doesn't have much glory to it. And it, in all reality, doesn't show a lot of reality because there is more reality than what you can capture in a photograph. Genesis 1 and 2 is more like a Van Gogh painting in that sense. And to state it plainly, I believe Genesis 1 and 2 is part of a long, complex, sophisticated, actually very sophisticated poetic prelude to the rest of the Bible. And if you look back at some of the theological big dogs of church history, those that are well known for writing many of the church principles that they got from the Bible over the years, that were not the biblical authors, but they were people who wrote about the Bible that established a lot of the teachings of developing Christianity, church history over the years. They didn't believe that Genesis, the 6 days of Genesis, the 7 days, we should say, of Genesis 1 and 2, were literal chronological days. But they thought they were figurative. They thought that they were very symbolic. I'm talking about Justin Martyr, who wrote in 100s AD, or Irenaeus, who wrote in the 100s AD, or Clement of Alexandria, who wrote in the 100s AD, or Origen, who wrote in the 200s AD, or Augustine. You might say Augustine. Nobody knows how to pronounce his name. Don't judge me. But Augustine, who wrote in the 400s AD, or Anselm, or Thomas Aquinas, who wrote in the early Middle Ages, all of whom said that these days were more than just straightforward chronological history, but that these days were figurative in some way. All of whom lived before and taught before any of the pressures of the modern claims of the natural scientists. So they weren't driven by science to come to their conclusions. They were driven to their conclusions by studying the Bible. And that's what we're going to look at today. I'm not a scientist. I'm not going to bring science into any of this. I just want to look at it from a biblical point of view. Genesis is anything but primitive. Just because I say it's 3,000 years old or 3,400 years old is not the same thing as saying it's primitive. In fact, the more I study Genesis, and this is our third time through it, frankly, and I study it each time, the more I study it, and even the older I get, the more I'm amazed I am at its sophistication. I'm quite dumbfounded at how sophisticated Genesis is all the way through the book. It's genius. It is a high literature, but it's very, very different than anything we have that we would read in our day. written about 3,400 years ago, probably by Moses, although nowhere in the Bible does it say it was written by Moses, but that's been the history of Jews over the years, of Israelites over the Israelites in the earlier years and Jews over the years. It was written by Moses after the Israelites had come out of their slavery in a very polytheistic Egypt. And they were wandering in the desert surrounded by very polytheistic pagan nations. And we can assume that they shared a lot, even though they might have been understanding the God of the Bible, they were no doubt quasi-polytheists themselves. We see that later as we get to the book of Exodus. There's no Bible to read for them. Genesis 1 is going to be the first of any of the Bible written. And it's written, we have to remember, to former slaves, probably uneducated, illiterate, who were wandering in the desert. So here's the question. If God is trying to change the worldview of a people who have been spending hundreds of years in a polytheistic Egypt and now spending time wandering around surrounded by polytheistic pagan nations, if God is going to change the worldview of these people, then probably an uneducated people, how's he going to do it? What would he say? How would he do it? What's the first thing he's going to tell them if he's going to change the worldview so that they see that there's one true God who has created the entire universe and who rules over everything in the universe? How does he do it? Well, he could just say that, I suppose. But in ancient literature, anytime you go back and read the literature where there is worldview transforming, worldview creating literature, it doesn't come in just straight prose narrative. It always comes in ancient poetry. And the reason why for that is because poetry was something better understood by less educated people because it incited the emotions. It helped people understand something with their imagination. So if I say to you, Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You've prepared a table for me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. And I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. None of the truths I've just said are literally true. God's not a shepherd in the shepherd sense. He doesn't have a rod and a staff. He's not anointing my head with oil. I don't know what cup is overflowing that I'm holding. And I don't know what the house of the Lord is all about. These are all figures of speech that communicate something that is truer than what could be understood if I just said some sort of straight narrative prose. It does something to my heart. And you know what else it does? It helps me remember it. The figures of speech, the wordplay, the way it's structured. I just decided to say that psalm this morning as I was preaching the first sermon. I didn't even prepare for it. I just have it memorized. I'm not boasting. I'm trying to show that poetry is easy to memorize because it does something inside of us and is structured in such a way with all the figures of speech, it's easy to retain. And that's why literary scholar Henry Immler says that often one of the reasons why poetry was used in the earliest years was because it was an easy thing to remember and retain by illiterate people as it was passed from one generation to the next. That's Genesis 1. And there are, in fact, highly sophisticated signs of the poetry of Genesis 1. Now, Hebrew poetry is not like English poetry. It's not going to have rhymes. Now, even though our poetry is less and less like that, the use of rhymes. But Hebrew poetry is going to use parallelism. It's going to use repetition. It's going to use figures of speech. It's going to use alliteration. It's going to use majestic, elevated language. It's going to use the symbolism, the symbolic use of numbers. It's going to have a cadence, a lot like our hip-hop does today. You're going to have cadence as you read the Hebrew. You're going to hear it skip and hop along with a kind of cadence. It's easy to remember that way, even though I couldn't remember verse 2, Tohu v'bohu v'hoshek. You can hear it skip along. I talked about a couple weeks ago. But in order for us to really talk about what it actually is, we have to actually read it. So we're going to look at Genesis chapter 1 all the way through chapter 2, verse 3. If you're very, very familiar with Genesis chapter 1, this would be a good time to use the restroom. But as we read it, I want you to notice something here. I want you to look at it differently. I want you to look at it not in terms of, gosh, how does our modern science fit within this chapter? I want you to not even look at it that way, because that was not the way the earliest author and readers looked at it. I want you to look at it through, do I see signs of repetition? Do I see signs of cadence? Do I see signs of poetry? Do I see a symbolic use of numbers? And is it telling me about how anything is done? No. It's telling me about the who, and it's telling me about the why. Let's just take a moment and read it here. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse, and it was so. And God called the expanse heaven, and there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. And God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. Now, I'm here to tell you that in ancient Hebrew, they had perfectly good words for the sun and the moon, but this is elevated language, the greater lights, the lesser lights to rule the night and day, and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens. So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas and let the birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things and beasts on the earth according to their kinds. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds and the livestock according to their kinds and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. Those are the ones we regret. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man. Now, not male, but man being both male and female. We'll see that in a minute. And then God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the ground. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. He created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the ground. Let's skip to verse 31. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation. Now, in our limited time here today, I'm not going to have near the time to show you all the really cool poetic markers in that chapter. We can't do it. So I'm just going to focus on one thing in the time we have left. One thing that you see in the ancient Hebrew, not the English, but in the ancient Hebrew text in which this was written, everything is in sevens. Seven was a highly symbolic number to the ancient Israelites. And it became a highly symbolic number, in fact, in the entire Bible, including the New Testament. The number seven absolutely dominates this section from chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 2, verse 3, in an amazing way. Again, in the Hebrew text, not in English, but in the Hebrew text, every word is carefully arranged. For example, the very first verse has exactly seven Hebrew words. The second verse doubles it, has two times seven Hebrew words. There are exactly seven paragraphs in the Hebrew, separated by evening and morning. And the concluding paragraph that we look at in Genesis 2, 1 through 3, has exactly five times seven Hebrew words, 35 Hebrew words in five groups of seven, exactly. But not just the number of times, number of words that are in sevens in the verse, but also the number of key words that appear seven times. So the word God in chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 2, verse 3, appears exactly in five groups of seven, exactly 35 times. The word for earth appears exactly three times seven. In this passage, in chapter 1, verse 1, verse 2, in chapter 2, verse 3. The word for heaven or expanse appears exactly three times seven. The repeated phrase, God saw that it was good or very good, occurs exactly seven times. But get this, when you get to the seventh paragraph that we look at in chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, the term seventh day is repeated three times, another significant number in the Bible, and each time it's in a phrase of exactly seven words. Let's look at it real quick. We're not going to be able to see what I'm saying in English, but I just want you to see the text. In Hebrew, the seventh day appears three times on the earth. It says, and on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy. Each one of those phrases, those verses that the word seventh day appears in, has exactly seven Hebrew words. Now, this is highly intentional Hebrew poetry. Every word counts. It's not just saying some sort of chronological narrative. Every single word counts, and it's in sevens. So Umberto Casuto, in his commentary on Genesis, writes this: to suppose that all these appearances of the number seven are mere coincidence is not possible. This numerical symmetry is, as it were, the golden thread that binds together all the parts of the section. All of this numerical symbolism is carefully intentional. I'm not saying the same thing as people who talk about a Bible code. This is not a Bible code with that has hidden meaning. That's not what this is at all. This is a poetic device, commonly used and understood in ancient Hebrew poetry. We also see it used by the Hebrew authors of the New Testament. So by the time we get to the Gospel of John, the Apostle John, who was Hebrew, was Jewish, he uses the number 7 to organize his entire gospel. And so he has 7 statements where Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the good shepherd. I am the true vine. I am the gate. He does that 7 times in the Gospel of John. There are also 7 times when Jesus just says the word I am. Before Abraham was born, I am. Don't be afraid, I am. 7 times. There are 7 miracles of Jesus in the Gospel of John. When you get to the last book of the Bible, the book of Revelation, there are 7 times that the same story is basically said. And so this is not a Bible code. It's an understood symbolism that Jews understood when it came to the number 7. The emphasis is on a theological point. It also helped with memorization. But in Genesis 1, the symbol of 7 is a view of the 7th day. The 7th day where God rested. And that word rest has the same Hebrew consonants as the Hebrew word 7. And the word rest was not in the sense of relaxation, but in the sense of completeness, fulfillment. When an ancient Israelite read or heard Genesis 1, the number 7 pointed to the goal of all creation. It is this rest, this completeness, this fulfillment. Now here's the point. Or I should say, here's another very highly symbolic, poetic pointer that tells us the point. And that is that unlike the previous 6 days, catch this, the 7th day, there is no mention of evening or morning. There is no beginning and there is no end. Unlike all the other 6 days, there is no beginning and there is no end to the 7th day. What's going on here? Why? I think the most simple and natural conclusion is that was drawn by Augustine, in 400 AD. And that is this. He says this, the 7th day was never finished. 7th day is still going on. It's still in play. It's still being unfolded. The 7th day exists without end. So in a sense, the creation story is still going on. And in fact, the New Testament specifically teaches that the 7th day is still going on to this very day. That we're still in the 7th day and that we are still waiting for the completion. We are still waiting for the fulfillment. These words that the number seven was always pointing to of the 7th day. Completion, fulfillment, rest. Not in the relaxation sense, but in the finally arrived sense. So Hebrews chapter 4, verse 4 says, he has spoken about the 7th day in these words, and now he quotes our passage, on the 7th day God rested from all his works. He goes on to say in verse 9, there remains then a Sabbath rest. This is figurative, symbolic, a 7th day. There remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For anyone who enters God's rest, God's completion, God's fulfillment, God's Sabbath, God's rest, everything theologically that the 7th day pointed to, anyone who enters God's rest also rests from their works just as God did from his. Let us therefore, he says, make every effort to enter that rest. It's still in play. It's the goal of your life. Not just the goal of Genesis 1, 1 through Genesis 2, 3, but the seventh day is the goal of your life, the New Testament says, to make every effort to enter that rest so that no one will perish. Perishing is not entering that rest. Perishing is not entering the seventh day. So the New Testament says the seventh day is symbolic, it's figurative of the new creation that we enter into by continuing to trust in Jesus. The New Testament says the seventh day has always been pointing to the new creation, the promise. Which means, of course, that the seventh day in Genesis 1 is not a literal day. It's a poetic day. It's a symbolic day. It's a figurative day. It was never finished. It continues. And we actually await it to be completed in the future for the people of God to enter into it, the new heaven and the new earth when Jesus returns. That's the seventh day of Genesis 2. So, let me get to my point. It seems to be reasonable to interpret the other 6 days the same way, right? If the seventh day is for sure figurative, for sure poetic, for sure symbolic, doesn't it seem reasonable that we would interpret the other 6 days of Genesis 1 the exact same way the New Testament interprets the seventh day? As poetic, as figurative, as symbolic? We should not interpret them literally chronological any more than we should interpret the seventh day as literally chronological. So why then the 6 days of Genesis 1? In the days that Genesis was written, the polytheistic pagan nations, they would build temples for their gods, their idols. And they would take 6 days after the temple was built, they would take 6 days to furnish and prepare and dedicate the temple so that on the seventh day the idol was brought in and it would rest upon its throne in the temple. God is using that common practice to say this. I don't reside in a building. You can't build a building for me. I created the universe as my temple. All of creation is my temple. And I made it for myself. And after 6 days, I come in on the seventh day and I rest on the throne of all the universe. All the creation is my temple, God says. And we know that the idea of him resting in his creation is the equivalent of God being sovereign ruler over all creation. And the sixth day told us that this rest of God, this ruling of God over his creation, God said, I'm going to make human beings in my image so that they can partner with me and rule over all creation. I'm going to allow human beings to be part of this amazing story, to be brought in to this amazing story of ruling over creation and everything that that means in caring for and loving and reflecting the glory of God as we rule over creation with God. It's a purpose that is delayed. We find out this in Genesis chapter 3. We'll get there. It's delayed when rebellion enters the human heart and the human condition, and we're kicked out of Eden to the thorns and thistles of death to this day. But a seventh day, all that is symbolized by the seventh day is still to be fulfilled. We still wait for it. It's a new heaven and a new earth fulfilled when Christ returns. I want to invite the music team back on, but I want to just say a couple things here. What does this mean? Well, one thing it means is don't let somebody who's trained in the natural sciences try to help you understand Genesis chapter 1. The other thing it means, though, is that Genesis 1 teaches us that God has this eternal planned out story that he has planned for all of his creation. And it's not finished yet. We're kind of in the earliest chapters. We're kind of in the 6 days. But a seventh day is coming. And Genesis 1 tells you that God has this eternal, glorious, special purpose for creating you to be a part of his creation. I know I say this a lot, but I really want to get this across because it really is what motivates me to run the race and finish the course. There's one story. There's just one story. It's told in microcosm in Genesis 1:1 through Genesis 2:3. It's this one story. You are not an accident. The universe is not an accident. It's not random. It's not by chance. God wants you to know him. God wants you to partner with him as we care for his creation, as we reflect his love and live in his glories in ways we have no idea until the seventh day comes. This exalted, this glorious, this eternal purpose that God has for you because he created you in his image. But you have to enter his rest. Hebrews says, make every effort to enter his rest so that you don't perish. So that you don't miss out on the story. So that you don't miss out on the seventh day. You have to enter his rest by continuing to trust in Jesus. If Jesus rose from the dead, and I think the overwhelming evidence is that he rose from the dead. If Jesus rose from the dead, that means that story is the story your life is in. It's the only story your life is in. It means the seventh day is going to be completed, and you can be in it. This is the story. Don't allow yourself to panic when your story is not going the way you want it to go and you panic and you try to find another story. You try to leave this story. There's no other story. There's no other story to go to. There's no other place to find meaning. There's no other place to find glory and purpose. It's only in this story. There is no other story. Stay in this story. Stay with Jesus. Don't let your heart drift. Don't let your heart be hardened, Hebrews says, so that you don't perish, but that you're able to enter the seventh day. Amen.